This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
So, in talking about the chant and emptiness, I want to reflect back on the prior week's sutra with the Metta Sutra, which talked more about the embodied practice and our embodied lives of sitting upright. The first most important point, I think, in this practice is uprightness. And it can be in any posture, but with attention to posture, with attention to the body. Generally trying to keep your spine as straight as possible, even stretching the spine to make it very erect. And chin back a little bit, and the lower part of your spine curved forward a little bit. Your legs crossed if possible, but it's not necessary. And with that kind of stiff posture, but mostly upright posture, attention to your breathing, and carrying that into your life. But relative to the Metta Sutra, which talks about at heart, and love, and carrying that into our daily lives, extending love over the entire world, above and beyond, and all around without limit. The Heart Sutra, the Prajnaparamita Sutra that we just did, talks about form and emptiness, and it's called the Wisdom Sutra. So they're a pair. One is sort of head, the other is heart. And they're not separate, they're actually interdependent. I think in Japanese there's only one word for the two of them, heart, mind, essentially. They're very, very closely related. So relative to other religions, this emptiness that we talked about has a flavor, a suggestion of the ultimate, of something that our minds and our senses cannot reach to. We'll go into that a little bit later in an easier, non-formal form, but most religions talk about your beliefs, your God, what is sacred and what is holy. And Zen practice, an embodied practice, as in Joe's talk about a month ago, is somewhat agnostic? No. Yeah, it really doesn't know. It doesn't take a position on that. It does not deny the sacred, but it doesn't necessarily insist on it either. Things like truth and source and love and goodness and beauty are in the realm that the Greeks used to call the realm of ideals, the realm of form. Forms, ideal forms, triangles was one. So just something that was perfect but that is not seen in nature and that we really can't have and touch and grasp and attach to. So emptiness suggests that, and yet all of our practice suggests that, but it doesn't insist on it. It's a more secular practice, and the word that I'm using today instead of emptiness is nothing. And part of the talk, if we have time at the end of it, will be to go into the mathematics and science of nothing. And I have a book with me called The Book of Nothing. And it is really the math and science of nothing in a fair amount of detail. But I'll postpone that to later, and also only if we have time and interest. One of the koans that sort of emphasized this point was of Bodhidharma's meeting with an emperor in China when he first came. Bodhidharma was the first Chinese patriarch, the fifth since Buddha, I think. Just the first Chinese patriarch. But he came from India and brought Buddhism to China. And in meeting the emperor asked him first, "How much merit have I, the emperor of China, acquired by fostering Buddhism, by building many temples, and by paying for maintenance and building this tradition in China?" Bodhidharma said, "No merit." And the emperor was somewhat taken aback, and he asked, "Well, can you tell me in your religion what is the most holy, what is the most sacred point, what is the most important?" Bodhidharma responded, "Nothing holy, vast emptiness." So, both nothing may and yet have reflected the nothing. May have reflected the sacred in Bodhidharma's mind. So, nothing holy, vast emptiness. In this practice, we're more down to earth, embodied, with just what we see and what we hear. Just this is one way of saying it. Another is suchness, what actually is. A Buddha is someone who sees things as they really are. One teacher in the Sierras has a set of three things that I think are good reminders throughout your practice. And the first of them is believe nothing in your practice. Don't take any beliefs into your practice. The second is attention. The third is not personal. Practice is not necessarily personal. It's not about me. It's not about me. This is all about me. I'm not making something up. It's about practice. In the sutra, we talk about relieving all suffering. And the first noble truth of Buddhism is, of course, suffering as pervading our egocentric existence. And the three other noble truths are that there can be an end to suffering, and that the way to the end of suffering is through the Eightfold Path of paying attention, basically. Paying attention to yourself, paying attention to some introspection, some awareness of senses and sensations and so on, breathing, what your mind is doing particularly. The mind, in a sense, does not exist. Only the physiology exists. Yet mind is probably the most important thing we talk about in Buddhism. It's an emergent reality rather than a quantum, mechanical-based, atomic, molecular reality. The reality is in the brain and the what the brain does, which gives rise to the mind. A number of TED Talks on this recently, if you're interested in pursuing it, what it's called, Your Mind Hallucinates Your Reality. And another is that emotions that came up recently as emotions are something that we ultimately can be responsible for. All of our emotions, including all of our suffering, are things that are generated I think in the nucleus accumbens, if I'm using the terminology right, but I'm not a neurobiologist, it's a small part of the brain, the amygdala is sort of the center of all that, and it responds to evolution's construction of the brain going back millions of years, and how it regulates your behavior, the first of which is in an emergency, if a tiger is pounding down on you, you need to react and you don't need to think. So the brain takes over, the lower part of the brain coming up from the spine and nervous system and senses and many, many areas of the brain. Basically, what I'm going to do in the talk is just do some readings from probably the most common book on this practice. Sold millions of copies, I believe, now. It's called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And there are copies available in the dining room that we'll have lunch in after the talk. So this is very valuable and down-to-earth collection of a number of talks that were given by Shinryu Suzuki Roshi in the mid to late 1960s at what was the forerunner of this particular temple. It was a home and then a garage in Los Altos, California, that our teacher, Koban, came to and to assist Suzuki Roshi in, I think, 1968 originally, and then he sort of took it over in about 1970 period and eventually moved it up here. So that's where we came from, and it's in part the teachings of Suzuki Roshi, who is a very valuable mentor to Koban before his death. Koban's death in Or Suzuki Roshi's death, I'm sorry. Koban also died tragically about 15 years ago. And while I'm on that topic, I'd like to say a word just to honor our guiding teacher who isn't here, Michael Shoho, Michael Newhall, who has been here since Koban's death, pretty much, and has maintained Jikoji and the temple and all of its caretakers, residents, for all those years and all the Sangha very faithfully, very wonderfully. And he'll be back in a couple of weeks, I think, so looking forward to that. There are many other sutras in addition to the Metta Sutra and the Prajnaparamita Sutra that we should mention in this practice, but most of them are touched on in another book that I'll refer you to. It's The Heart of Buddha's Teachings by Thich Nhat Hanh, and it talks about the sutra on the full awareness of breathing is an important beginning. Just paying attention to your breathing. The four foundations of mindfulness. The seven factors of awakening. The eight jhanas, the levels of concentration in your practice. The six paramitas. All those are important, and along with the paramita and the Metta Sutra. But the key point in all of those sutras is to return, to remind yourself of your body, your senses, your sensations, your awareness, the change that's going on continuously. We call it returning because when we sit, our minds get caught up continuously in thinking, doing other things. And we suddenly become aware, frequently become aware of our thinking. And what we do when we do that is to return, to greet and acknowledge our thoughts and maybe investigate them a little bit, and then to let them go. So where there is non-thinking in this practice, in reminding, in attention to what you're doing, and also non-hindering in letting your thoughts go, letting them flow, letting them drop off, paying attention, returning. It's also called reminding, and I love that particular term, just bringing your mind back to your current, to the present. The only thing we ever have is really the present, plus our intellect, of course, and our memory and all our brain's faculties. But in the practice, what we do is to return and remind time and again. It's also the way to listen to a Dharma talk. Just whenever you're aware that you're drifting off or analyzing or on a different topic, just to come back, bring your mind gently back. Don't worry about remembering or the like. If you have a sense of what's being said, that is what you, that's your inheritance from having taken the trouble to have sat through a painful and long-lasting Dharma talk. So, back to nothing. There, first section that I want to mention is literally entitled Emptiness. And it says, when you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning of your mind. If you want to understand Buddhism, is it necessary for you to forget all of your preconceived ideas? This is what we mean by believe nothing, I think. To begin with, you must also give up the idea of substantiality or existence. Usual view of life is rooted in the idea of existence, I am. More on that a little bit later. It also says, when you study Buddhism, you should have a general house cleaning of your mind. You must take everything out of your room and clean it thoroughly. If it is necessary, you may bring everything back in again. But if they're not necessary, there's no reason to keep them. If you're concentrated on your breathing, you will forget yourself. And if you forget yourself, you will be concentrated on your breathing. There's no need to try too hard to be concentrated on your breathing. Just do as much as you can. If you continue this practice, eventually you will experience the true existence which comes from emptiness. Turning to another section, this one on God-giving. To give is non-attachment. That is, just not to attach to anything is to give. In relation to your thoughts come from virtually nowhere. And to acknowledge them, let them go back, let them go, is non-attachment to your thinking. When we sit, we are nothing. We do not even realize what we are. We just sit. We don't try for some special feeling tone or for some special realization or appreciation, understanding. We just sit. But when we stand up, we are there. This is the first step in creation. Dogen Zenji said, to give is non-attachment. The first paramita on generosity, Milarepa, another ancient teacher, said something like, just stop fixating on self. Just whatever it is, don't necessarily fixate on yourself in the process. So in another section that's actually entitled Believing in Nothing, starts out with, in our everyday life, our thinking is 99% self-centered. That's self-centered on, why do I have suffering? Why do I have trouble? What's wrong with me? I got into that when I was in the 7th grade. I knew there was something wrong. So it is in his conclusion, which I personally doubt, is it is absolutely necessary for everyone to believe in nothing. But I do not believe mean voidness. There is something in... there is something, but that something is something which is always prepared for taking some particular word, for form, and it has some rules or theory or truth in exact activity. This is called Buddha nature or Buddha himself. And as a personal note, I also, when I got into this practice, believed that there was something beyond physical and even intellectual underlying all of human existence, some spirit, maybe, if you want to call that. But I've since abandoned that because we've gone through a few years of science and Buddhism, and I think everything that is has some physical embodiment as well. So if there, to this extent, this is, I think, consistent with Christian mysticism and Christian theology too. God is one in unity, but he's somehow, there's a relationship, and it's not something that you can grasp or attach to. So believing in nothing is important. There's one final section on naturalness in our practice. Being natural, coming back to our true nature, is one aspect of practice. I think that in part to me is egolessness, just being, but I'll go into that more. This naturalness is very difficult to explain, but if you can just sit and experience the actuality of nothingness in your practice, there is no need to explain. If it comes out of nothingness, whatever you do is natural, and that is true activity. You have the true joy of practice, the true joy of life in it. Everything comes out of nothingness, moment after moment. Moment after moment, we have the true joy of life. So we say, Shin Kyu Myo U. From true emptiness, the wondrous being appears. Shin is true, Ku is emptiness, Myo is wondrous, Yu is being. From true emptiness, wondrous being. Koban said, Koban is the original founder and our original teacher, followed Shinryu Suzuki and maintained Jokoji for 40 years or so, 30 years maybe, and my teacher, my original teacher, before Michael. He said that one must disappear in the sitting. It is the only way. So, again, Shinryu Suzuki said, you must just sit. You feel and sense your sitting, And in it, there is great activity, great dynamics, great movement. And you know, from my tendency is to revert to sort of scientific or science-based background. You know that in your brain, for example, there are billions of neurons triggering every millisecond. So many interconnections happening, so much going on, and all that relates more to the homeostasis of the body, keeping the body constant, and the mind, adapting the mind. So something's happening, and I believe it's a relaxation of your mind. It's a letting your mind get out of your normal self-centered perspectives, my self-centered perspective, and go back to just a natural way of being. And the this kind of absorption that Koban is talking about in your sitting practice, which happens increasingly as you sit, and even more so as you go to intensive retreats, leads to increasing concentration. I lost the thought that I had when I started into that, I'm sorry. But it is a wonderful practice. You can describe it all and justify it all just in terms of psychological or emotional well-being, a way of taking care of yourself. It's, I think, a very healthy way of taking care of yourself. It does lead to increasing compassion, increasing love and awareness and sensitivity to others. There's something called the Four Immeasurable Minds in Suzuki or in Thich Nhat Hanh's book. And one of them, they are, I think, loving kindness. That comes up in the Metta Sutra also, for just as a mother is her taking over her only child, that kind of attitude. The next is compassion. Once you have that feeling, you have great compassion for all of us. We're all in it together. And we're all suffering. Joy sharing is a practice that's very key to our practice. And the fourth that I think I started to mention or wanted to mention was equanimity, constancy. So in this practice of allowing your mind to relax and to come back to yourself, to your true self, your original nature, you're contributing to that equanimity. And the equanimity is itself a form of love, of honoring all of our existence and all of our being together in this practice. So I think we still have, how much time do we have? I should have. 10 minutes?
16.
Just 10?
16,
thank you. I have very poor hearing, so that's one reason for my continuing to talk instead of listening. let me go through briefly some scientific perspectives. One in the sort of the psychological realm the realm of human behavior, is that from a man named Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize, for doing initial sort of pioneering studies and proving that our human thinking is pretty deeply biased. It's never sort of neutral, never as a Buddha's thinking might be, or only in our best moments perhaps. In a sense, it's always true that we're all Buddhas in every second, and Buddha's way is actually being actualized as we speak. And it is in every moment. Kahneman said something like, nothing is more important than what you're thinking about while you're thinking about it. So when you're thinking, when you're absorbed in a thought, you're actually, that's the most important thing in the world to you. If you take that in its other meaning, nothing itself is more important than that. Another kind of light perspective on this comes from saying that happiness is being absorbed in something greater, is dissolving into something greater. And Einstein reputedly said something like, nothing is greater than human ignorance. And there is a dual sense of that nothing, too. Literally, our ignorance, our intellect extends from the quantum realm up to the cosmos and to all of our literature, all of our compositions, all of our teachings. And yet ignorance vastly, vastly transcends it. And you only have to look at where we are now in terms of our understanding as to where we were a generation ago to understand how much ignorance has been transcended, how much more we know now about both the quantum and the cosmos and ourselves. So our ignorance is perhaps the transcendent thing, except for the alternative interpretation, which I love, is nothing itself is more important than human ignorance. So this nothing in our practice is more important to us than everything that we're ignoring, which includes almost everything at every moment. We go on in our ignorance. In math, the most basic form of math is counting the integers. You start with one, and you have a successor function, and you generate all the integers. But if you try to complete that, you need a predecessor function, a minus. So you subtract one, and you get to zero, nothing. That nothing has some rather peculiar properties. It works wondrously. You can also generate all the negative numbers, and you can do addition and multiplication, subtraction with the integers. But when you get to division, you can do wondrous things. Because you take this zero and you multiply it times anything, and you get zero. I take the zero and multiply it by anything else, and I get zero. So I can say zero times A equals zero times B. And if I divide that equation by zero, I just cancel the zeros in the numerator and denominator, and I've proven that A equals B, completely independent of what A and B are. This is, in a sense, the basis of equality, as in liberty, fraternity, and equality, but it's also purely nonsense. So in mathematics, they use a workaround. Our minds can't grasp this zero and how to use it. So we preclude dividing by zero. It's not legal. Or we call it a singularity. It blows everything up. It is infinity. Nothing is very important in mathematics. In metamathematics, there's something called the self. And there's also something called all of logic in metamathematics starts from axioms and rules of inference. Simple ways of generating increasing systems, and you can prove that you can generate almost any system from very simple rules and very simple axioms. Basis for geometry 2,500 years ago. But you can also prove that some statements are neither true nor false. Like words lie is both true and false, and this sentence is false. Is both true and false. So in any context where you're referring to self, a kind of a zero, there's this quality called self-referential. And statements that are self-referential in logic are result in paradox. So in science, we can't really handle those. In math, In science, we talk about vacuums as being the representative of nothing. But we can't really produce a vacuum. We can try. We can pump everything out of a enclosed volume to an incredible degree. But there's still the volumes container will radiate. So even though you get every atom out of the container, there's still something there, and it's radiation. And if you think in terms of outer space, where you also think of nothing, it's true that every source of radiation penetrates everywhere, almost, in the universe. So our sun is shining every place in the universe. Every star is shining. And every bit of space, unless it's completely blocked, has some radiation from somewhere. They call this the zero-point energy of physics. It's very, very important in physics. So there are lots of problems in our mind and in our thinking and in our intellect that I think this practice leads to peace with. You understand the limits of your mind and intellect and senses. And there is nothing, there's emptiness. And yet, we cannot own it. Owning stuff is the basis for ego. My possessions, my body, my mind, my thinking, etc. It's the egocentric existence. So I think that's more than enough. And I'll open. We have some time, I think, before lunch. So if you have questions or comments, I think I'll let you talk to each other, and I'll interject if I feel appropriate. But would anyone like to say anything or ask any questions about nothing? Or about something.
Since this is my first time, I want to understand what enlightenment truly is and how this body can get there or achieve that level of spirituality.
It's a big, 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 important question. My practical realization is that it's suddenly, maybe in sesshin, maybe in practice, you realize that you've had some weird aspect of thinking, maybe a neurosis or something, some emotional context in your mind that's been catching you and just repeating a certain context over and over, and that the process of seeing it, watching it, paying attention to it, relaxes the body and mind. And you don't necessarily go there again. The next time you see that happening, you say, I've been there before. I know what it is. And I'm just here, now, this, what is. I'm centered in my body. I'm not caught in my believing and denying and wanting. There are many other forms of enlightenment that the teachings talk to. Some of them Satori or Kensho, experiences of oneness. But there's also, it has this and yet, and I can't reach to God or to enlightenment completely. I know that I used to be a lot crazier than I am now, and I attribute it to this practice.
So would you say that it's something that you step in and then you step out? So it's never like constantly always happening.
Moment by moment. We only have this present. No, there's only change. The whole one foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness is awareness of change. Everything is changing, including your thoughts, feelings, emotions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Your talk about nothing, whenever that word comes up, I always reflect on this. Confusing but lovely little essay by Martin Heidegger on, it's called, I believe, The Way Back into Metaphysics. And he starts out with asking, what is science? And his very simple definition is, science is the study of what is, and nothing more, he adds. And then he launches into this analysis of, well, what is nothing? And to even talk about it is sort of to turn into an object. But nothing is not an object, and it's not a thing, which he's very clear on that. And it, I remember giving it to a friend of mine once, he said, he's just playing with words. And I says, yeah, that's what philosophers do. They play with words. Try to tease out these words we use all the time, but kind of don't have a sense. And I don't know if it's in that essay, but it's certainly a big aspect of his thinking is we come to terms and understand the importance of our being because of our sense of annihilation. And nothing. With one thing, even the most confirmed skeptic knows in their heart is that they're going to die. They might want to say, well, I don't know, but in actuality, we are all convinced of our impending death. We may not think about it, or we might console ourselves with thoughts of the afterlife, but you might believe that you're going to live in an afterlife, but that's not as certain as your belief that you're going to die. And so he makes quite this point of something that none of us have experienced, nothingness, but that it's like there and always in the background of our life, and that gives us this sense of the preciousness of our existence. And so at times it comes up, I mean, we all, I think, well, I do anyway, will I question, what am I doing with my life? I know I'm not going to live that much longer now. Every birthday or every, you know, it's more and more evident that I'm on that threshold of death, and how do I want to spend this last moment? I don't want to be on my deathbed feeling that I've wasted this opportunity. So that's another way of looking at nothing, perhaps.
Thank you. Lance will lead a 2 p.m. discussion where we might return to this topic, and mostly on actually in here, I think. So at 2 p.m. after lunch, we'll have a little break after lunch also, and hopefully, what do you do in Zen? How do you really practice? Well, one of the key practices is to help with the dishes after lunch. So if you can do that, we'd welcome that. But come back to the 2 p.m. discussion of social psychology and philosophy, and maybe behavior in the local community. enough. Nothing else, we'll close with a chant. This is a traditional. I'd like to maybe add at the end of the chant another version of the chant which our root teacher, Koban, gave, but please.
May our intentions equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way.
Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it.
And what I'd like to add to that is Koban's somewhat playful version that he actually wrote down and we have still in our hearts. It starts with, beings are numberless, they will save themselves. Desires are inexhaustible, they will find an end of themselves. The Buddha, the Dharma gates are endless. Therefore, there is learning and study. The Buddha way is not above. It is actualized in every moment.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.